Welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast. My name is Leanne. I'm your host. I'm a speech and language pathologist in California. And this is a podcast all about the many wonderful things in our profession of speech language pathology. And right now we're doing a series called How I Practice, where I'm interviewing SLPs who talk about how they practice. I know it's very straightforward. It's excellent. Today I'm joined by Irene Chacko, and I'm very excited about our topic, where she's going to be talking about how she really learned to find her voice to advocate for her patients and give her patients a voice. And all of this came about during a very traumatic time in all of our lives during the COVID-19 situation. So I don't want to spoil anything because I think this is a great story. I want to say all the things, but I'm gonna hold back. And I'm going to welcome you, Irene, to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Leanne. I just want to let you know how thankful I am for you to have this podcast. Because a couple months ago when I was out on maternity leave, a month before I went back to work, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know how to be a speech pathologist. So I listened to all of your episodes in the back and in the background while changing diapers and putting my baby to sleep. And I've learned so much insight and resources from your speakers that I use now. So thank you so much for what you're doing. And I'm very honored to be part of it.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad. I think it's so fun that like the listener becomes the guest. Like that is the coolest. I'm so thrilled. All right. Okay. So, well, tell me a little bit more about you. So you're a recent mom. I got that.
Yes, a recent mom. She's 11 months now. I am a practicing SLP based off of New York. I've been an SLP for 7 years now, graduated from New York Medical College, and always knew I wanted to be in the adult population, but just wasn't sure what setting was my area. So I tried them all out. I've been in acute care. I've been acute rehab, skilled nursing facilities, home care. And currently I am in my dream job of outpatient, specializing in adult neuro, and in the process of getting my CBIS. Hopefully that will happen soon. So yeah, that's just a little bit about me.
That's awesome. Yay for another like dream job outpatient SLP. I'm one too. I love it.
It's awesome. I really, really enjoy what I do. And based off of what I've learned and my experience of advocating for patients, it definitely has transitioned into this setting as well. So that's really exciting as well.
Cool. Okay, Irene. Well, everyone is like holding their breath in suspense. Let's save them from themselves and tell me, how did you find your voice by advocating for your patients to find their voice? How did all of this come about, especially during COVID, our favorite time?
Yes. It was in 2020. I was working at a hospital that was predominantly acute rehab. It did have a small med-surg floor. And I'll never forget, my supervisor got all of the PTs, OTs, speech therapists there and said, hey, you know, we're going to have to eventually see these patients. We were in the acute rehab side, so we didn't really get an influx of COVID patients at that point, but they were filling in med-surg. So for whatever odd reason, I volunteered to be the med-surg SLP. And I said, I'll do it. I think during that time, now that I'm processing it all, it was so scary. You know, we really didn't know what we were doing. But I think I just wanted to help out. There was just so much uncertainties and just sadness. You know, we would see the morgue truck outside, and I just really wanted to lend a helping hand. So that was kind of my reason to be the one to volunteer. And I was actually one of the first therapists at that hospital that saw a COVID patient. So it was a wild journey. And I say all this because it really propelled the start of the next couple of months and my journey with treating COVID-19 patients. So our hospital was chosen to be a pilot program to attain patients that were hand-selected. These were patients that have been hospitalized for months that were on the ventilator, trach pegged, but cognitively intact over the COVID precautions. The acute care hospitals just did not have the right support or resources to wean them off. So they decided, let's transfer a bunch of them over to our hospital and see how they do with rehabilitation. So I was chosen to be the lead SLP. And I will say, you know, I've only been a speech therapist for 7 years, but thus far, that experience has truly been an experience, because we were all handpicked. There was an OT, a PT, RTs, RNs, hospitalist, you know, you name it, but it was the same people every single day. And it was so nice, because you don't really see that in acute care. And we all had this mission to get these people for safe discharge, or get them to the next step, which was acute rehab, which was for them to go down to the second level and get 3 hours of therapy. We were a well-oiled machine, a team of occupational therapists, physical therapists, RNs, NPs, RTs, hospitalists. And what was really interesting about this team was the continuity. We were the same team every single day. We did debriefments in the morning and in the afternoon. And we all had the same passion and the same motivation to really help these people. And I think it all stems back from during that time. Again, there was just so much uncertainties and so much grief that here we are trying to help these people who have been through so much and getting them to safe discharge and improving their quality of life. So that experience. So all in all, that's a little bit about the program. I don't know if you want to ask me any questions or if I should just continue on.
Oh yeah, I do have a question. So you mentioned your hospital is mostly acute rehab, which I'm in the habit of calling inpatient rehab. It's same difference, right? So that is where patients are being medically managed by a physical rehab doctor, and they get 3 hours of therapy a day divided between PT, OT, and speech, if speech is even on the caseload for that patient. But your pilot program was in your med-surg unit, which is like a version of acute care. I mean, it is acute care. There's just all different, you know, there might be ICU units on acute care, et cetera, et cetera. So med-surg is one of the units in acute.
Yes. I should have specified that. It was such a, you know, that unit was actually broken down after these 16 patients. It was really a unique unit. They just created one. It was in between med-surg and inpatient rehab. It was, these patients were in med-surg for months at a time. Now they're being transferred to, you know, they're medically okay, but they're not candidates just yet to be getting 3 hours of intense therapy that inpatient rehab qualifies you for.
So it's almost like a step between acute care and inpatient rehab. So they're basically medically stable, but they're still, are they still vent dependent and had PEG tubes too? So like they were still in a pretty bad way. Like they needed some shoring up before they could really be successful in a unit like inpatient rehab.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where the whole idea came from of this program of, we need to, I guess the other hospitals were just, they were at max capacity. They weren't able to wean these patients off properly or didn't have the manpower at that point. And they knew that these patients, there, a lot of them were young. So they knew that they didn't have any other comorbidities other than getting COVID and having all these complications arise from it. So that's what I mean by they hand selected these patients, because in the hopes that they will eventually get to acute rehab or inpatient rehab.
Okay. All right. Cool. Okay. I got it. Yeah. Cause I wasn't sure if this was like a specialized unit inside of inpatient rehab, but really it was like the step before that.
Exactly. Yes.
Got it.
So my responsibilities now is to help them with communication and also get them on POPs. So I could talk about the communication part of it, but the finding my voice and advocating was really stemming from getting them to start having PO feeds. All of them were weaned off of ventilator, and we were able to get them on PMSV. And I'm like, okay, it's time for them to do their modified barium swallow studies. So I asked for orders, thinking that I'll get the order and I'll get them to do the swallow study. But I was met with resistance only from one person, and he was the main person. He was the head of pulmonology and the lead MD in this unit. And he just said no. I never even got a chance to speak to him directly. I actually reached out to the hospitalist to put the order in. And the hospitalist asked me, can you send me some literature about this? Which I thought was just such, you know, it was a breath of fresh air, and I loved it. And after I spent time with this hospitalist, he had, he was very supportive of this as well. But he came to head with the head of pulmonology, who was saying, let's just wait. Like, why now? Why do we have to do this right now? Let's do this after they're decannulated and once they're in acute rehab, you know, why are you pushing for this objective testing right now? And fair, fair reason and justification. However, my thinking is I'm seeing my physical therapist and my occupational therapist all getting these patients up in atoms and working on their muscles. So why can't I? And I need an objective assessment to figure out what their baseline is and to figure out a plan of care and goals for them. So what I did first was I went to my supervisor, and who's an occupational therapist, and I told her, I'm like, listen, we need to get this objective testing done. We need to start these patients on dysphagia treatment. And she was very supportive, and I asked her if we can have a meeting. And she was like, yeah, sure. And I was like, you know what? Get that hospitalist in this meeting as well, because he was so supportive. So we ended up having a meeting with my supervisor, myself, the pulmonologist, the hospitalist, and then some of the team from pulmonology was there as well. So very nerve-wracking. I had all of my literature, and I pretty much told them, you know, nothing that's new. Everything was supported by evidence-based practice of the importance of how prolonged intubation causes dysphagia, and how every day that a patient doesn't swallow is increasing their chance of deconditioned muscles and muscle atrophy. And I'll never forget what he said. He looked at me and he goes, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I don't change my plan or my treatment approach, but that doesn't mean that I can't change it. And he was very, you know, he was on board with it, and I was very, very appreciative. And he even at the end of the meeting, he was very appreciative of that I went through all of this to get his ear and to tell him about this. And he said, I wish more speech therapists, you know, stepped up and did things like this. And it made me think, oh gosh, like, you've seen other speech therapists. Like, there had to have been somewhere in your journey where speech therapists didn't advocate, or maybe they didn't inform as well as you would have liked to, or whatever. Like, there had to be a reason why he said that. And that just all the more made me get more fueled up about how so vitally important it is, not just to advocate for our patients, but for our field, you know? So yeah.
I love that story, Irene. I'm like over here on pins and needles, because I'm like, you did what? He said what? That's amazing. This is so cool. And I was noticing while you were telling your story, one thing that you didn't touch on, and I don't know if, like, maybe you, it just didn't come up in your story, or if you didn't experience it. And that is, like, during this time, we're all like, oh, this is so new. We don't know anything about it. We don't have any literature to really support, like, clinical decision-making and things like that. But you were like, we have a lot of evidence that lets us know about trached patients and swallowing and what's best for them. Just like you mentioned, you know, the longer they go deconditioned and not swallowing, the worse outcomes are likely for them. And if PT and OT are working on those muscles and getting them up out of bed, why are we ignoring another incredibly important life skill that they're going to need for the rest of their life? You know, it's like once you pop that tube out, they just don't automatically go back to swallowing. Ideally, that's what we want. Yeah, sometimes that might happen. But when patients get so deconditioned, I mean, you were talking about these folks being in the hospital for multiple months. Like, yikes, people. That's a lot of deconditioning. So the other thing that I was so impressed with is that you were like, okay, so in my head, I'm like, I'm the specialist on my tiny little slice of the medical field that is communication, cognition, and swallowing and how all those interplay, right? That's our slice as an SLP. Pulmonology is obviously the expert on the lungs and the breathing. But they also have that larger medical knowledge that like I did not go to school for like 10 years plus to get, right? So like I have a lot of respect for that. And if they're like, well, this is how it needs to be because of XYZ, and you were like, he told you those reasons. And you were like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But you were like, however, let me go back to what I'm the expert in. And I need you to know this too. Like that just makes my heart sing, Irene. I love it.
It's, you would think that I was always like this, but that was the first time in my career where I used my voice, you know, and I don't know what it was, just the perfect storm, if you will, of the situation we were in. And just also these patients, I'm seeing them daily. They are alert. They are communicating with me using their PMSV and using low tech communication boards. They want to eat. They want to drink. They are expressing that to me. Their family members are expressing that to me. So it was also that it all stemmed from that. It all stemmed from these patients have been through so much, you know. Yes, I am a very small part of this team, but I realized that I am a person at the table, you know, and we are part of this healthcare system, and there is a role for us that really should be taken seriously. And I think prior to that event, you know, a little bit about personally, I'm a very timid, I am not the typical type A SLP that you see. I'm very type B, kind of go with the flow. I've had so many experiences where a doctor will say something and I'll run to the bathroom and cry. And, you know, I just didn't have that voice or that I just didn't have that confidence really to let others know that I am just as resourceful as anyone else here. And it only took this experience or this very traumatic experience to lead me to that moment and really that meeting and what he said and how he was so, and listen, it's not going to happen all the time, right? But for me, it did. And I feel like it happened in such a way that allowed me to completely change how I go about treating my patients. And that's advocating for them in every which way.
That's awesome. Okay. So you've talked a bit about kind of the status of these patients. And I think, what I read from kind of your notes leading up to this, and I can't remember if you've already mentioned this or not, but there were eventually 16 patients who were admitted to that unit, that you and your team were working with during that time. Tell me about their status. Kind of give me just that baseline, what was going on with them when they all kind of arrived, and then talk about when they discharged and maybe like where they discharged to, kind of what was the next steps. What were the outcomes of this unit and obviously specifically your intervention, because that's what we're here for today.
Yeah. And there will be more details to that from the PowerPoint that I've given in the show notes, and it'll give more. I actually collected data on these patients. So of the 16 patients, we saw 11 out of the 16 received modified barium swallow and placed on PO thereafter. And that was mainly because the others quickly were decannulated or quickly were brought to acute rehab where they received modified barium swallows. But so I was able to do modifieds on 11 out of the 16. And all of them were placed on PO right after. And eventually all 16 were, out of the 16, 12 were discharged to inpatient rehab. And all 12 were placed on diets. And 12 of those patients were discharged home on regular and thin. And all 12 patients were discharged in a modified independence or intermittent supervision for cognitive related tasks. So I looked at their communication and cognitive status as well. So all in all, they were all out of the ones that we were able to start remediation for, they were all placed on diets and eventually were discharged on regular and thin or on somewhat of a modified diet.
Okay. So coming out of that first modified barium swallow study, they were all able to be put on some sort of PO diet. So it wasn't like a go directly to thin regular, but they were able to be on something. Did you do, what kind of dysphagia therapy might have followed up with some of these? Like what were some that pop up? Because I know every patient's going to be very different, very individual with what was going on with their swallow. But if you just want to give me kind of a rundown of some things that you were doing, I'm curious. Tell me more.
So I made it a point to be there for their meals because it's been like 5-6 months since they started eating by mouth, right? So that's the first thing we did is I was there for their meals. So say somebody was, you know, I recommended puree and thin liquids and was there for their entire meal, had RT was there as well. And we really monitored closely their respiratory status. And so that was part of it is just getting them to eat, right? That's part of the therapy that we provide. In with that, we also did oral pharyngeal exercises. EMST was also given to these patients, the device. That was given more to inpatient rehab status just because they were just not at the level they needed to be on my unit. But that was part of it. And that was all. It was really just getting them to tolerate, you know, most of them weren't able to handle a meal because it's been, like I said, a prolonged amount of time. So some of them, we even just started with some snacks. We would do small meals throughout the day. And we were very, you know, we had good communication with the kitchen staff on making sure that it wasn't like these three big meals per day. And had a lot of education with nursing and in being able to monitor them and make sure. But I think my number one goal when I recommended them to start eating and drinking was really that supervision of when they are eating and making sure that they're okay with with all of, you know, there's stamina that we're looking at, right? There's endurance, all of these things we're looking at. So that was pretty much the main focus. And then shortly after, they all went to inpatient rehab where they got, like I said, EMST, and the speech therapist there did much more rigorous dysphagia intervention.
Excellent. Okay, yeah. So, they were just coming off of, like, the first word that popped in my head was bed rest, but I'm sure it wasn't very restful. they've been deconditioned for so long, just starting back with eating, just making sure everything's going well. And you said RT was there. So, you know, you're monitoring respiratory status as well. And during that time that they were with you before and also during their transition to inpatient rehab, did any of them develop any other kinds of like respiratory infection or anything that you're aware of?
not that, yeah, that was something. We would have those debriefments in the morning. So they all would have routinely chest x-rays that were being done, just the status of, right, these are patients that are constantly being weaned off from ventilation, then PMSV, then capped, and then eventually decannulated. So for each of them, that was varied a lot. So in the mornings and sometimes in the afternoon, we would have debriefments again. And we would definitely go through their labs and chest x-rays. And so I was very much aware of how their respiratory status was. And that kind of was why I was saying it was such a well-oiled team, because everyone really looked out for each other in that way. And we all communicated in a way that was benefiting each of us. We did a lot of collaboration too, that I just remembered, where even just them sitting up, the physical therapist would be there, you know, working on trunk support. OT would be there to help with feeding. And then I'm there to, you know, assist with the meal. So a lot of collaboration also was there. And yeah.
That's awesome. What a unique experience. And I love that you pointed out, like, what a tight-knit working team it became, because it was the same group day in and day out working with the same patients, like constant communication. That's a gift, right? That's really nice.
Yeah. That's why I said, in the last 7 years, honestly, like, that experience was just so unique that I always thought, I'm like, I need to write this down or document this, or this has to be, and here we are. So this is great. I blinked and it was all over. I'm like, what just happened? You know, this was amazing. And, so definitely it was a very unique and fulfilling time in my career.
Out of curiosity, did all 16 come around the same time, like maybe within a week span? And then once they all were gone to their next level of care, that was it? There was no more unit? What was the time? Okay, also, because we can see each other, but no one else can. Irene's nodding her head yes to those questions. So then my follow-up question is, what was the time frame that unit was in operation?
Yeah, it wasn't long. And that's why I say I blink and it was done. I want to say it was between 3 to 4 months.
That's not a short amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's longer than 3 to 4 weeks, but you know, on the grand scheme of things, like, that is a short amount. That's like a quarter or less of a year, about a quarter of a year, right?
Yeah. Because so many, most of them did well. The ones that didn't, and that's why I said the 16, only 11, like, it wasn't 100% success rate. And I think, a couple of them did end up having to go back to the hospitals that they came from, for whatever reason, medically. Some of them didn't go to inpatient rehab. They went straight to skilled nursing facility. So, it was a fast, it started out slow, you know, their transition of weaning off, but as soon as they were weaned off, their recovery was very quick.
Yes. So kind of the goal of that unit was to wean them off of the ventilation.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the main goal for the medical team.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So that they could, because in inpatient rehab, not that we didn't get patients on the ventilator, but you know, it's very hard to do rehab, especially 3 hours of rehab for those patients. So that was a major goal, was to at least get them on the pacemaker before they were discharged to inpatient rehab.
Awesome. All right. Another question that I just remembered I had earlier that I've forgotten. I'm so excited that I remembered it again, is the PEG tube. At what stage were they only having that removed, like if they were in inpatient rehab, for those going to skilled nursing, did they have the PEG tube taken out before that? Because they don't do that in a SNF. Like, they're like, no, that's a hospital thing. I don't know. Fill me in.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. For the ones that went to inpatient rehab, I do remember a lot of them still had their pegs, just because we wanted, you know, and the doctors really wanted to make sure that they're able to handle, like, this is where dietary comes in to play, and handle PO feeds. And it mostly had to do with their endurance and their stamina. And these are patients, right, are deconditioned over months and months and just weak overall. So that was a huge point of it too. So yes, a lot of them did have their pegs in inpatient rehab. Eventually, before they went over to skilled nursing facility or discharged home, all of their pegs were taken out. Yeah. From what I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. For the ones that you started on diets, were their peg feeds adjusted any? Because I feel like in my practice, like in my history, I've had patients that, and for many different reasons, and sometimes it is from feeling fullness with bolus feeds, like they're just not interested in eating as much. I could imagine it's a very different feeling for these folks who are like, I haven't had it for months. And they're like, yes, please. Were there any complications with bolus feeds and eating by mouth at the same time?
The dietary team was excellent. We had, a team member that I forgot to mention, but they were also part of this team. They would also be there for debriefment. When they found out that a patient was being recommended PO feeds, they instantly put them on bolus feed and decreased their intake. So they did, they were very aware of our plans, and it all worked out nicely. I don't recall there ever being a situation where there was ever any friction between the two or between the patient and how much they were able to tolerate. I mean, there was a lot of, we did have to change things up, and that's why, like, some patients, they couldn't tolerate a full meal. So, you know, dietary would talk about, you know, they still have a lot of wounds that need to be closed up from being prone and things like that. So right now we need to keep them on, supplement. So that's where, you know, I had to say, okay, like, this is important for them to get their swallow muscles stronger. But what they're saying is actually more important at that moment, right? So that's where we would, instead of offering three meals, we would then say, okay, let's just do snacks to start off with, you know, get their medical status to be a little bit more improved, and then we can start with meals. So yeah, definitely those were discussions that had to be had.
Excellent. Well, I've really enjoyed hearing about your story and getting to follow up with all my nosy questions. You're the best for fielding them. It's just so, you know, we've all had very different experiences working in healthcare during COVID-19. And I absolutely love hearing these amazing success stories that you were able to find, like, another, like, unlock another level of, like, career advancement and achievement by advocating and finding better outcomes for your patients. Like, that's what we do. That's what we're all out there doing, right? And so I really get excited about these stories. Were there any other areas that you wanted to touch on before we wrap up?
No, I think the main takeaway is just, you know, this experience really led me to, like I said, advocate. And right now I'm in an outpatient site, and still, I know COVID is long and gone and hopefully a thing of the past. But whoever is listening, and I think this story, I hope, will translate really to people that are coming right out of grad school or the younger clinicians, because like I said, I was in that, I was that timid little speech therapist that didn't want to speak up for my patients. And I think it's really important. And hopefully the story will give you that confidence of knowing that our voice is important. And when we forget about all the little things you know, what will people think, or will I sound, you know, dumb, or, you know, are people, what if the doctor says things, or what if the nurses say things, like all of those noises that we all have in our minds. I think if we instead focus on the patient and focus on what they want, I feel like it will really give us a purpose in being able to really deliver good therapeutic approaches and ultimately improve their quality of life. So that's really the message that I have today, is just how important it is to advocate, even when it's hard and it's difficult, and how important it is to advocate not just for our patients, for our fields, for ourselves. And so hopefully that will just continue to promote our field and help us to be the best clinicians that we can.
Excellent. Well said, Irene. I love it. These are my favorite stories. Thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your story and what you've learned and passing on that inspiration to the rest of us. I want to encourage our listeners to visit the show notes on speechuncensored.com, where you can see Irene's slide deck that she created to share about this whole situation. I just lost all my words. And all the outcomes are all listed there, and the research is listed, so you can go check those out. And I hope this conversation has nourished your brain so that your practice can flourish and you go out there and be awesome. Thanks again, Irene. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Leanne.